Hey, does anybody have questions about the old exam?
Yes.
Really? Okay.
Absolutely.
Well, now's a good time to bring them up. And if you have questions, there's probably some other folks that have them as well. So I'd be happy to spend a little bit of time here on that. So let's hear them.
All right. Which letter represents a vowel? Oh, you have to bring up the pictures. I have a question.
Okay, let me get those. Okay, these are the pictures.
Is it which sort of represents a volcanic ash mantle? What was that? I was thinking like, I don't know, because it's hard because I know it's D's, like if that's a forest one. Is it like, I thought it was E?
E is probably the best answer. Okay. I think D might have been acceptable as well, but that's probably the better one, at least morphologically, for the ash-mantled soil.
All right.
One thing, keep in mind, some of these have more than one possible answer, okay? And that would not be uncommon for a number of the questions.
On the fill in the blank ones.
Uh-huh.
When you, can I, like on number C, I didn't, were you looking for like a designate or were you looking for?
Well, which one's C? I don't have
organic matter percentage of a prairie A horizon.
Organic matter percent of a prairie A horizon.
7 to 8.
Well, yeah, don't put a range, just single number.
20
is pretty high.
No.
Probably 5%, 6% would be a very reasonable number. Remember, it's a mineral soil horizon, so you've got to have something less than 20%. Yeah.
So if you just wrote less than 20% in there, would that be wrong?
Well, don't put a range down, all right? I didn't say that explicitly, I don't think, but just put a number in. Because if you say less than 20%, 19, that's not a very common number for organic matter content of a prairie soil.
For the pictures you have of the soil receiving less precipitation,
uh-huh.
I'm going with A.
Because?
It looks like a mollisol, very dark A horizon.
And it is.
You got your calcium carbonates down there.
Yeah, this is what I'd be looking at, the calcium carbonate down there.
And then for prismatic structure, that I would also call that for A. So which one has? Which soil has the best expression of prismatic structure?
Okay.
I would say an A also.
Okay, that sounds good to me.
Can I have a question? Like, I thought that grasslands received a lot of precipitation. Like, I thought they were...
Not compared to a forest.
Yeah.
So, and you look at the grasslands in the west, they're usually the drier areas, occasionally sometimes foothills, but considerably less than the forests are going to get.
I was going east.
There are grasslands in humid regions, but by and large, they tend to have less precip.
On D, is that an example of melanization?
On D?
Yeah.
Well, I guess you could argue that point. It's actually D is a good example of podzolization. Yeah, the accumulation of alluvial humus and iron and aluminum.
Would any of those be a good example of melanization?
I don't know about any of them. I'd say there's at least two that are better than others. A would be a very good example of melanization, possibly C, but I'd say of those, A would be the best.
So what's going on with that then? Because that's on a lot of the slides, and I just kept thinking.
What's going on with?
With those little dark spots.
This? In D?
Yeah.
That is alluvial humus, where you would have a BH type of, or BHS. Uh-huh. We talked about podzolization, the chemical migration of accumulation of alluvial humus, usually with iron and aluminum. Other questions?
Yeah, 2A. says horizon, or horizon formed by calcification and cementation.
Horizon formed by calcification and cementation, okay.
So since it says formed, I guess that kind of threw me off there because I just thought it was BKM.
Okay. That's what I was thinking of, BKM. If it asks for a horizon, yeah, that's, how else would you describe the horizon? We haven't talked about diagnostic horizons yet, like calcic horizon and things of that sort, so.
What on number like G, were you looking, soil with effective rooting depth of 20 centimeters, were you looking for a designation? Were you looking for like the class, like very shallow or?
Well, if it's talking about the soil, it's not a specific horizon, but yeah, very shallow would be a good answer for that one.
Or D, subordinate distinction D.
I don't know that D would, it doesn't seem like a very good answer because number one, when you're writing down a horizon, you need to have a master horizon symbol and a subordinate distinction. Just a small d by itself really doesn't indicate much. So if you indicated it was maybe a BD horizon that was within 20 centimeters of the surface or something like that, I guess that would be reasonable. But that question is really just about soil depth.
Okay.
Craig.
Number nine, you have dense versus cemented soil. And the only thing I had in my roots about that was just that cemented roots could find their way through the cracks, but they're both restricted aside from.
They are, but the difference is a cemented horizon will not slake in water. Remember, I had the demonstration down in lab. There was a fragipan, which is a dense horizon, but it's not cemented. And what happened to that after it sat in water?
It fell
apart. Yeah, it just fell apart. It completely slaked. Something that is cemented, though, has a cementing agent that causes the material to not slake. And you can have calcium carbonate, it's probably the most common cementing agent. But silica, gypsum would be other possibilities. And sometimes even the alluvial humus can cause cemented horizon. Yes.
I think someone mentioned this before, but going back to it, so like with the volcanic ash horizon, like usually you can tell by like the lithologic discontinuity if mm-hmm. there's if it's labeled on there. But how do you tell, like with this, what would give it away that it's a volcanic ash?
Okay, on E, what would indicate that's a volcanic ash mantle soil from around here? Okay, you've got this color up top, this mantle of material.
And the change in color in the bottom?
Well, it's a fairly abrupt change in color too. So I guess the idea of those would be that there's some type of a lithologic discontinuity. And there are other profiles that might have gravelly material down here, but some sort of a definite change. And the ash-mantled soils around here, it's, I think I've said, that it's pretty typically this reddish-brown stuff that's a foot or two up at the surface.
I think I sometimes just have a hard time telling the difference between lithologic discontinuity and just like a change in horizon type and like minerals, just lack of experience, I guess.
But. Okay, well, and that's understandable, but one thing you might think about is just process of elimination, okay? So if you're thinking about which would possibly be ash-mantled soils, I think if you went through these, well, like somebody said, that looks like a grassland soil there. And does it say forest soil in there? It could.
I don't think it does.
I thought that there was a post.
Oh, okay.
Just say from off and
on. Yeah, there's a forest.
Well,
from Northern Idaho.
Yeah, what I would suggest is just see which ones you can rule out, okay? And I think there'd be several that would, you know, don't seem like likely candidates. And then if you get it down to a couple of them, then well, that's a last resort, you could guess. But hopefully it would be an educated guess. Yeah?
I have a question about number six. I know that like poorly drained soils have like a low chroma colors, and then I know that well drained soils have like high chroma colors. But when it comes to the value, couldn't you have in between those really like for a glazation like the poorly drained soils? When you have like a light gray to a really dark gray, like.
But they would always be low chroma.
Low chromas.
Yeah.
So it doesn't really. What about the values? Don't really.
Well, it, not so much.
Okay.
But they're always low chroma. You won't have a soil that's undergone glazation that has high chroma.
So there's not like a high value or a low value associated with it? Or
well, generally the colors that you associate with the BG horizons or CG horizons are gonna be a color value or a chroma of 2 or less. And there's really no stipulation on color value per se.
Wake up.
The numbers.
Yeah. Yes.
What's the difference, organic matter percent between OI/OA?
The organic matter the content.
Yeah.
Between OI and OA, there is no difference. They're both.
It's just the matter decomposition.
Yeah, it's just the decomposition. Decomposition. Right. And normally that's assessed by looking at what they call rub fiber content. And something that's OI has a lot of plant fibers in it, and something that's OA would have relatively few plant fibers in it when you moisten it up and rub it in your hands.
Do you ever put with respect to the question, do you always have like, when you, like on one of those questions it was OI and then O, like E or something like that, A and E, do you ever, can you sometimes just put the whole like, an organic top layer, does it matter?
I don't think I've ever seen that done, but
okay.
It's sort of sending mixed messages if you do that.
For the P horizon, I mean, would you just put O then, or did you want?
You've got to use a subordinate distinction with O, so you'd put it. P would be an example of OI material because it's got a lot of plant fibers in it. Anything else?
Structure in a C horizon.
Structure in a C horizon.
Structureless, massive.
Would probably be the best answer, because if you have structure in a C horizon, you're soil structure is considered significant alteration of parent material when you develop soil structure. So the mere fact that you have it probably means that you should be calling something a B horizon or A horizon, depending on the situation.
Can you use an R then, like a CR designation, like a slightly weathered?
Well, C with the small r, it means something very specific. And we talked about the soft weathered bedrock. So it has rock structure in it. That's part of the definition.
What was the answer over there? I didn't hear what you said.
What's the
structure? For structure of a C horizon?
Yeah.
Either structureless or massive would be. Structureless or massive. Somebody might put single grain, that's okay too. When you talk about structureless, it's really the two possibilities are that it's massive, meaning it's just one big mass of material without smaller aggregates, or it's single grain where there's no aggregation, like in a very sandy material.
Sorry.
Yes.
Between structureless and weak, the W is the difference, because you cannot see a structure. So in a weak development of.
Well, I don't think that would be true. With weak structure, it's still there. It's just the degree of expression is considerably less than you might otherwise expect.
So you still can see something.
Oh yeah, you'll see something. It's if you. Typically the way you do it is you have a knife or something that you can pick away at the soil horizon, and you sort of look at the way that the material falls out. And in the case of structureless, well, it's just going to be one big mass of something, or it's going to be individual grains of sand. But if you notice aggregation, then that is going to qualify as at least weak structure. Anything else? Okay, well, what you can do this afternoon is just come to this room at 1:30, and then you can take the exam. It doesn't take that long. You might figure on somewhere around 30 minutes. It's not a lengthy exam, so you'll be done pretty quickly. And then we do have a lab for this afternoon, and it's going to be on soil parent materials. And there's actually a couple of aspects to it. One is I've got a lot of samples of different rocks that I'll have out in the lab. And this is sort of a geology 101 type thing. But if you've never had a chance to look at examples of igneous rocks and sedimentary rocks and metamorphic rocks, this might be a good opportunity to do so. Thinking about and we talked about this the other day, the mineralogy, the grain size, some of those characteristics. It's more of a show and tell type of lab. And then what I want to spend a few minutes here talking about this morning is this idea of what type of a surficial deposit is this parent material. Is it something that's blown in or washed in? And we have some specific terminology for that. And the idea being, when you're describing parent material of a soil, to the degree possible, you want to try and say something about the rock type or the lithology, the mineralogy, if you can. And you also want to say something about the type of surficial deposit. Is it a windblown deposit? Is it a water-laid deposit, gravity-laid deposit? And so I want to just run through a few examples of surficial deposits for you. And this is there's a little presentation on your that's on the website that it covers this stuff. But really, if you think about the surficial deposits, we can put them into one of two categories, and they were either be transported or they're not transported. Okay, so it's a very easy distinction to make between the two. And if we talk about the transported types of parent materials, we've got different agents that transport them. There's wind, we call these aeolian deposits. If water is the agent moving or transporting it, generally if it's faster moving water, we term that alluvium. There's a lot of these alluvium words in here, you know, eluvial, illuvial. Well, here's another one, alluvial. And this just refers to deposition by running water. If it's slow-moving water, like you would have in a lake type of environment, we call those lacustrine deposits more typically. If ice is the transporting agent, the general term might be something like glacial till, which would be one of these deposits that's the mixture of all these different particle sizes. And I'll show you an example. Sometimes it's glacial outwash, where you have meltwaters that are emanating from the glacier, in which case the deposit probably looks a lot like some sort of an alluvial deposit or alluvium. And then finally, gravity, very common transporting agent, and those types of deposits are referred to as colluvium. It's another alluvium word. And then, of course, the non-transported parent materials, we simply refer to those sorts of deposits as residual, or the material would be called residuum, meaning that it hasn't been moved anywhere. It's just more or less formed there in place. And I'll show you some examples of these things. Aeolian parent materials, the windblown around here, best examples. Volcanic ash is maybe one of the more impressive ones. And we typically see these up on the surface of a lot of our soils around here. Luss, we talked about this the other day. This is the primarily silt-sized material that is blown by the wind, and a lot of the luss that we have around here in the Palouse is, we talked about the creation of this rock flour through glacial activity, and then the water carries it, it's deposited, it dries out, the wind picks it up, blows it over here, and we get these nice, deep, silty soils with high water holding capacity and great dry land farming soils as a result. So this term, it's actually German. It's probably pronounced Lurs, something along those lines. Most folks just say Lus, but it's primarily silt-sized material that has been deposited by the wind. Sand, a little bit coarser. You've all seen sand dunes, I'm sure. And if you're looking for clues that it's sand that's laid down as a result of wind versus water, a lot of times in a soil profile, what you'll see is something called cross bedding, where you see the sands kind of laid in at different angles that you might expect on a dune. Because you see in the background this picture on the left, you imagine that the slopes on that dune, and then you might have the wind shift and you get the sand going a different direction, so you might see a different orientation of the sand. If it's an alluvial deposit, it's generally going to be more evenly bedded or layered in a more or less horizontal type appearance. The thing about sand, though, as an aeolian material, it generally does not get carried as far as loss. So if you're looking at windblown sands, they're generally not very far from the source of the material, just because it takes a lot more energy to carry sand particles than it does the finer lust particles. This would be an example of an alluvial type of setting where you've got a river, and here's the floodplain off to the side. And generally, anywhere you would go on that floodplain, you could characterize the parent material as alluvium or an alluvial deposit. Now, because when you look at the flow of rivers, this is constantly going to be changing courses. Sometimes it may flood in places and go over the banks and deposit stuff. So there's a lot of spatial variability when you get into these big alluvial deposits. But a few things that you can say about them. Number one is they almost always tend to be stratified. And what I mean by that is there is a very distinct layering pattern. And generally, these different stratified layers reflect different types of flood events and often the energy associated with them. For example, this profile on the left, you can see some of the gravel and cobbles down there. Well, you know, that's pretty fast-moving water. It's a very energetic system if you're carrying those size of fragments around. Whereas if you get into some of these, you can't really tell it in the picture, but these are probably finer. It might even be, you know, sand or coarse silt textured materials. But you'll see this layering pattern that reflects the energy of deposition. And this is another example. I think I showed you this one before. Just this, all of these layers reflecting various flood events. Yes, Larry.
So when you put a soil description together on something like that, would you go from an alluvial deposit to a lacustrine above it?
No, I think a lot of it would simply be based on the fact that you've got this real thick stratified soil profile. I think you call it all alluvium. And you might mention that it varies from, you know, fine sand to gravel or cobble-sized material, but there would be a number of ways to handle it. But I don't think anybody would want, these are feet, so this is 4 feet. This would be about 8 feet down here. I don't think anybody wants to go through and try and pull out every single little layer in there and describe it separately. You could do it, but you're making a lot of work for yourself, and I think losing sight of the bigger point. It's just, this is a series of water lane deposits. Another example of alluvium, and this would be gravel, cobble-sized stuff, reflecting a much higher energy of deposition. And you notice how, in this case, a little bit difficult to see, but all these rocks, they show what is called imbrication. In other words, they're all sort of laying in a preferred orientation. And this often tells you something about the direction of the current and those types of things. But it may be something that you'll see in an alluvial deposit that is consisting of coarser rock fragments like this.
What's the word?
It's called imbrication, imbrication.
Which way was the water, left or right? Or?
I think on this one, it would be left to right. And if you looked it closely through this whole section of gravels and cobbles, you probably can find some variation in the mean rock fragment size. And again, it would be a stratification. You know, looks like these are a little finer in through here, it gets big again. So you almost always are going to find these stratified layers of some kind. Lacustrine deposits may be a little more difficult to pick up, but if you look at the bottom of this profile, down in here, you see the thin laminar type of fabric down there, these very thin layers. It's finer textured stuff, which is one clue. And primarily, you would expect silt-sized material and lacustrine deposits. Maybe some fine sands, but generally silt-sized. And it often has this characteristic layering that you see. Unlike alluvial deposits, it tends to be a little bit more uniform, though. Because in a lake, you usually get this annual cycle where material is deposited in there, it collects, and then the cycle's repeated each year. You know, when you get spring runoff, that's when you probably would expect the most deposition. And there's actually a couple monoliths here that have some of these lake sediments in the bottom that you can take a look at. But somebody might look at that and say, well, you know, that looks like platy soil structure. And it kind of does. It's definitely a platiness to it, but I think you could make the argument that in this case, that's not really soil structure. That's just a feature that's inherited from the lacustrine parent material. And generally, if you're going to find platy soil structure in the soil, it's going to be up closer to the surface. So one thing you might watch out for, I wouldn't call that platy soil structure. It's just more of a feature of the parent material. This is a landscape from down near McCall, so about 1,000 feet or about a mile high elevation. Notice these big rocks sitting around on the surface. There's not much there for scale, but it seems to be about the size of a four-wheeler or something like that. These are what are referred to as glacial erratics. And the idea is that you get these rocks sitting out there, and there's no apparent source of where they would come from. It's not like you're looking at the base of a cliff where you've got rock outcrop and the rocks would just come down the cliff. And this is something that's often very typical of glacial till, is that you see these rocks that are often on the surface, sometimes very large. And I showed you this soil profile before. This is the soil known as the McCall series. And the characteristic of this soil profile is what we call a very poorly sorted deposit. And by poorly sorted, what I mean is that it has the complete range of particle sizes in there. Everything from clay to looks like boulder sized material. And it's all jumbled up. And this kind of gets back to the way that ice moves over the landscape and what it does to the substrate, in that it just pushes it up like a bulldozer, mixes it all together, and so you end up with this very poorly sorted type of deposit. Now, if you contrast that with a lust deposit, you know, we would consider a lust deposit to be very well sorted. It has a very narrow range of particle sizes in it. And a lot of alluvial deposits, at least within a stratification, are very well sorted. They have a very narrow particle size, but poorly sorted here. Glacial outwash looks a lot like alluvium. I guess the only way that you would really know it's glacial outwash is that you happen to be in an area that was on the margins of the where the ice advanced. You can see this down here, kind of stratified in here, a little bit coarser, a little bit finer. This is another ash-mantled soil, and you kind of see that characteristic reddish-brown color, and in this case, sitting over something that's clearly a pretty different type of parent material. So just an example of lithologic discontinuity. Yeah,
Craig? So the glacial erratics you're talking about, those larger boulders, they have to be on the surface?
Well, you'll often see them on the surface, because, again, this deposit is just pushed along, so they'll be throughout. But a lot of them stick up at the surface.
So the difference between glacial till and outwash is more that the outwash tends to be smaller particles because it's
on the more
fringes? It tends to be deposited by the meltwaters rather than just by the action of the ice. And having said that, I should point out that there really is a whole continuum between what you would, might call glacial till versus glacial outwash. And it's not always going to be a clean-cut case of, well, it's obviously one or the other. I'm sort of showing you the examples of each extreme. But you've got everything in between. And then finally, when you get into landscapes with steep slopes, as you get to the lower slope positions, like the foot slopes, you very typically will find colluvial deposits. So this is gravity and gravity-carried material. You notice all the rock fragments throughout here. Again, an example of a very poorly sorted type of deposit. So there's a whole mix of particle sizes in there, sand, silt, clay, rock fragments, and they do tend to be sort of jumbled up because imagine this going down the hill under the force of gravity, it's going to tend to mix everything up pretty well. Now, what do you notice about these rock fragments versus the ones that I showed you in the real thick alluvial deposit?
They're sharp.
Yeah, these are angular, they're sharp, and this is another clue that can help you distinguish between the type of surficial deposit. Generally speaking, colluvium tends to have these broken rocks, they're sharp, they have edges on them. Anything that's been worked substantially by water tends to be very well rounded or smooth. So, and sometimes you'll find, again, the whole continuum between what you would clearly recognize as alluvium versus something you would clearly recognize as colluvium. It's like you see rocks in here that look kind of rounded, and it you know, it's not always clear cut, I guess is the point. Well, then you do have some soils that form in residual material or residuum. And in this case, you can see some sort of a bedrock here. You've got rock structure down there, maybe a good example of a C with a little R, CR horizon. And I don't know about the stuff on top of it. Maybe that blew in or washed in, but clearly the lower part of that soil, at least the CR material, is residual in nature. It was not transported.
Consider that to be an R bedrock?
Well, it looks like somebody dug through it pretty easily. Maybe they used dynamite, I don't know, but I think that it's smoothed off pretty nicely. So I'm guessing CR. Some other residual materials, you know, organic parent materials, might be an example of something that is not really transported. We talked about these shallow organic soils in the craters of the moon where the plant actually provides the litter that creates the organic soil. So it's not being transported other than maybe from somewhere up here to dropping down on the rock surface. And the same thing with deep organic deposits like peats. That's the plant material is the parent material that is growing right there, it dies, it's laid down, and these things just end up building up over time, but it's not really being transported anywhere. Okay, so that's just a quick look at some surficial deposits. And what I'm going to have you do in lab this afternoon, there'll be a select number of monoliths. I think there's 8 of them. I believe that's right. Anyway, go around and look at them and see what you can come up with in terms of a description of the parent material. And so as you're doing that, keep in mind this idea that maybe you can say something about the mineralogy or rock type. Like I think most of you recognize granite, right? And you could say, yeah, it looks like it's granite. But then also things that you can say about the type of surficial deposit. Does it look like it's windblown, water-laid, gravity-deposited, that sort of thing. So you can try your hand at it. Okay, well, I want to take the rest of the time and talk a little bit about time as a soil-forming factor. We haven't said too much about it, and it's a little bit different than the other soil-forming factors because by itself, it really doesn't do anything. It's not adding anything to the soil or influencing it, other than it's more or less the chronological framework for how long all of the processes have been going on. And more often than not, when we talk about time as a soil forming factor, it's pretty difficult to talk about absolute age. In other words, I can ask you, when's your birthday, when you were born, and you know exactly how old you are. It's a lot more of a problem when you deal with soils. And because of that, we often think about soils and time more or less as a developmental type of a stage. In other words, maybe you've heard the term young soils. And these might be soils that you find along a floodplain or soils that are geologically very young. And typically the implication here is that if we say it's a young soil, we mean that it does not show very much development. And I think I might have talked about senile soils. Some of these soils from the humid tropics that are very old and very highly weathered, they might be rust piles dominated by iron and aluminum oxide, sort of over the hill type soils. Same thing, it's a relative stage of development. And for a long time, we could also put mature soils in here. And these might be the ones that we think of as being more or less in equilibrium with their current environment, or the quote, normal soil that you'd expect to find someplace. Like around here, a mollisol would be the mature type of soil we'd expect to see formed under grassland vegetation under these climatic conditions. So this is really a developmental type of thing. But we can talk about absolute dating or absolute ages with soils. And it's just a little more difficult. Now, if we wanted to know the absolute age of a soil, what would be some ways we could do it? Okay, carbon. This is the main one. Soil carbon, and what's the technique that we use to get some sort of an age? Yeah, we just call it carbon dating, right? Or C14. Dating, radiocarbon dating. It goes by several different names. But the idea here is that carbon-14 is an unstable isotope. It has a half-life of 5,730 years old, meaning that half of it will decompose or in that time frame. And we can use it in soils because we have two major components of soils that consist of carbon. One of them is? Not plant material, but soil organic matter, right? And what would be the other carbon that we might find in soils? Well, that's going to be in the organic realm, but somebody said it. Yeah, calcium carbonate. So generally, you'll refer to these as organic carbon and inorganic carbon. But those offer potential for using C14 dating, radiocarbon dating. Has anyone ever done this or sent samples in to have this done? Well, let's talk about some of the disadvantages of it. One of them, it's fairly expensive. Depending on where you go, a lot of people use this beta analytical lab in Florida for carbon dating. And the last samples I sent off is probably a couple years ago, but it generally starts at about $300 a sample. Might have gone up a little bit. So, $300 a pop, it's easy to burn through some money in a hurry. So it can run into some costs. And if you don't have large quantities of whatever it is you're trying to date, say it's charcoal that you find in a soil profile, you have to use these accelerated techniques, and then you start looking at something on the order of about $1,000 per sample. So it starts to add up pretty quickly in terms of the money. What would be some other disadvantages of carbon dating?
You can't can't date young soil or young. It has to be a certain age, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, you've got some time constraints. And obviously, if you go out and look at something really young, it's going to be difficult. And same thing if you go out and look at something really old. And in fact, if you look at the half-life of C14, you're looking at something on the order of about 50,000 years. And once you get to that length of time, there is going to be so little C14 left in a sample that it's essentially dead, and you can't use it to date things beyond about 50,000 years. And obviously, there's a lot of soils and soil materials that are older than 50,000 years, so it does have that sort of a limitation. And yeah, it doesn't work real well if it's extremely young soil. You might be able to say, well, it's less than 100 years old, but that's about it. Another problem, if you think about soil organic matter and trying to date that, what would happen if we went out here in the lawn outside the building, dug up the top part of the A horizon, and thought, yeah, we're going to find out how old this soil is. We send that into the lab to get a C14 date. What's going to happen when that gets analyzed in terms of the age constraints on that soil organic matter? Well, what you're probably going to see, I'm just making this number up, but you'll often see the carbon date given. They'll have an age like this, and then it'll have a plus or minus associated with it. And if you dig up an A horizon, you're probably going to get something like this, where, yeah, there is an average age to that carbon, but it is such a wide range, because remember, this soil organic matter pool is a very dynamic pool. You're constantly adding new carbon to it, and there's real old carbon in there. So if you have this analyzed, you're getting an average of all of that. And it's probably going to be an average that ends up with you having a very poorly constrained date. So sometimes things like charcoal work really well. If you can find some charcoal down at a depth in soil, you can get an age on that charcoal, and that will help you determine the actual age of the soil profile. But there are problems associated with the C14 dating. But that said, a lot of what we know about some rates of soil formation, are a lot of that work is simply based on the radiocarbon dating. So it's been really useful. People are working a lot more with trying to date inorganic carbon, like in calcium carbonate, because it turns out that if you look at carbonate accumulation in a soil, it usually happens in sort of an episodic type of an event. And if you're careful, and you might be able to scrape down through layers of calcium carbonate and actually get ages on the earliest ages that carbonate was being deposited. A lot of possibilities there, but it's a pretty difficult thing to do. What would be some other ways we could get an absolute age on a soil?
Reference point
such as
having an ash.
Okay. In the Pacific Northwest, it wouldn't be uncommon to go out and look at a soil profile. There might be a nice little volcanic ash layer in there. And if you can correlate that ash layer to a specific eruption, which we generally can do, those are usually pretty well constrained as far as age. We know that the Mount Mazama eruption was 7,600 years ago, plus or minus 50 years or something like that. But that's pretty good age control. And some of the Mount St. Helens eruptions got very good, well-constrained ages on those as well. So that's another, we call this tephra dating. Tephra is simply the name for any thing that's blown out of a volcano, whether it's ash or pumice or larger materials.
About basalt flowing over the landscape.
Another good example, there are a lot of techniques that have been developed for dating rocks. And there's things like potassium-argon series dating that it involves isotopes. I think they use uranium and lead dating series. And I'm certainly not an expert on these things, but you can come up with dates of the rock. So if you have rock that flows over, or basalt that might be over top of the soil, and you get an age on that basalt, it tells you something about the age of the soil. Yeah, Bryce?
With all the other forming factors, what is the significance of knowing the time? Why does it benefit?
Well, there's some specific examples where it could be really important, and one that comes to mind is in California. I know a lot of soils consultants that are making a great deal of money by going out and looking at faults and trying to determine the exact age of that fault, because it's kind of relevant, as you know, when is it an active fault, is it an older fault? And so that would be one example where an exact age might be a pretty useful bit of information. But you kind of raise a good point. In general, it doesn't matter that much. You know, that's where we get back to this idea of young soils, mature soils, old soils. That's maybe a more important concept. Yeah, Kat?
Can you use silica?
People have been experimenting using silicon isotopes. And a lot of these are, they're developmental. You know, they might work in some cases, but there really haven't been too many things that have the universal application that something like radiocarbon dating has. People are doing work with a lot of different stable isotopes. They have these things called thermoluminescence dating, and it's all kind of related, but they're largely experimental. Well, one of the questions that always comes up is how long does it take to form a soil? And you know, you think about, well, why does that matter? Well, if you think about erosion, and a lot of the targets for soil conservation are kind of geared towards what's the maximum amount of erosion that is tolerable without destroying the long-term productivity of that soil. So in order to answer that question, you kind of need to know, well, how quickly does that soil form? We can measure erosion, so we know how rapidly it's being lost. But can we tell how rapidly it forms? So if you get asked the question, how long does it take to form a soil, what's your answer going to be?
Okay.
It depends. It's a great answer. And it depends on a lot of stuff. Number one, it depends on what type of horizon you're talking about. And I guess we better save this till next time. But just to elaborate a little bit more on that, how long does it take to form an O-horizon? Maybe a decade, you know. If you think about a forest litter layer, it doesn't take long at all. How long does it take to form a BO horizon?
A little bit longer.
Yeah, a little bit longer. So you've got an extremely wide range, and maybe what we'll do on Tuesday is kind of lay out some of these horizons and the relative time frame that it might take to form them. But the best answer for that question is it depends. Oh, in any kind of science, that's usually the best answer.